Okay, well, as I said, we're in Luke chapter 22. Jesus has just repaired the damage done to the ear of Malchus, the servant of the high priest, by Peter. And he's been arrested and taken to the house of the high priest. And there's a meeting there now of the Sanhedrin. And while this meeting is taking place, a young girl spots Peter and she says, "This man was also with Jesus." And then a man pipes up and says, "You are also one of them." And of course, Peter denies Jesus on both counts. And then as we pick it up today in verse 59 of Luke 22, it says this: "And about the space of 1 hour after, another confidently affirmed, saying, 'Of a truth, this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean.'" So it appears that Peter's accent is the thing that gives him away. And I find that really interesting, because I also believe that true believers are identified by their speech as well. And the reason I believe that is because true believers have an accent of another kingdom. You know, true believers don't use the same expressions or talk about the same things. Our tone is different, and we have a different vocabulary. They're not the same as those used out there in the world. What does it say in Colossians 3? It says there, "But now you also put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not to one another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on a new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him." Verse 60 says this. It says, "And Peter said, 'Man, I know not what you say.'" He's saying, "I've got a clue what you're talking about." "And immediately while he yet spoke, the cock crew." So the cock's crowed, and Peter is now no longer quite so cocky. Because before he was, "Oh, you can rely on me. I'll go with you even to death." But we'll see that when he's writing his epistles, that he'll describe himself as Simon Peter, a servant of Jesus Christ. Because the Lord changed Simon's name to Peter, meaning rock or stone. So after this event that we're looking at here, it was as if he said, "Yeah, okay, I'm Peter in the Lord and by his grace, but I'm still also Simon because I know my tendency to fail." And I also think there's something else here as well as we look at this, because I believe that in using a rooster, the Lord was telling Peter that even though he messed up, and even though he committed a, well, singularly hideous sin in denying him, even as Jesus was about to die for him, there would be a new day dawning, a new day of humility and of brokenness and of forgiveness, after which God would use this man in a really mighty way. And I hope the same is true of you and me, because I also believe that we will find that the Lord will do a mighty work in and through us if, at the point of failure, we turn to him. Now, verse 61 says this. It said, "And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, 'Before the cock crow, you shall deny me three times.' And Peter went out and wept bitterly." Now, I know we've looked at this before, but the look with which Jesus looked upon Peter, it wasn't one of condemnation, but of compassion. It wasn't a look of fury, but of forgiveness. And it broke Peter's heart. "And the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him. And when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, 'Prophesy, who is it that smote you?' And many other things blasphemously spoke they against him." And you know, again, I think it's so interesting that, most of us have this, you know, we've got this kind of mental image of these events in our mind, haven't we? But according to the prophecy in Isaiah, the beating that Jesus endured was far more brutal than any beating ever experienced by any other man. So I think maybe we need to erase that mental image of Jesus that we so often see. You know, the one with a single trickle of blood down his face. Because that's not what happened, okay? And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together. And they led him into their council, saying, "Are you the Christ? Tell us." And he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God." Then said they all, "Are you then the Son of God?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." And they said, "Well, what need we any further witness? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth." Now, you see, what they're doing here is they're making Jesus out to be just an ordinary man. The Alexandrians did exactly the same thing. And they're the ones who are responsible for the text that most of the modern versions of the Bible is taken from. And pretty much every cult there's ever been diminishes the deity of Jesus Christ. And they say, well, Jesus never claimed to be God. And yet, you see, the chief priests and the scribes here, they began to carry out this crucifixion for the single reason that by the way he answered them, they understood that he claimed to be God. You see, the issue of Jesus' deity is foundational and essential to our faith. I mean, why couldn't he simply be the first created one, as the Mormons claim? Why couldn't he just be a good teacher, but not really God? Well, simply because if Jesus Christ wasn't God, then God did not die for me. And then suddenly the Bible loses all of its potency. But you see, the thing is, God didn't simply create a sacrificial son to take care of the sin of mankind. No, God himself died for me. And the fact that Jesus is God in the flesh, it moves me and it breaks me and it touches me in a way nothing else possibly could. In 1 Timothy 3:16, it tells us that. It says, "And without controversy or controversy, whichever way you like to pronounce that word, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the word, received up into glory." You see, God became a man when Jesus Christ was born in Bethlehem, when the word became flesh and dwelt among us. And because of that, in answer to any question I have about the way life should be lived, I don't have to wait for an inner revelation or sign up for a seminar to get instruction. All I have to do is to look at Emmanuel, God with us, Jesus. And I think too many people are looking for a manual on how to raise kids or how to be a better husband or how to live successfully. Well, forget the manuals. We have Emmanuel. Now, verse 1 of chapter 23 says this. "And the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate." Now, they take him to Pilate. And the reason for it was because under Roman rule, the Jews didn't technically have the authority to mete out capital punishment. So Jesus had to be brought before Pilate. And I actually think that that raises another very interesting question, because having said that, when we look in Acts chapter 7, we see the Jews themselves stoning Stephen. It didn't stop them taking the law into their own hands then, did it? So the question is, if they killed Stephen, why didn't the Jewish leaders kill Jesus for his perceived blasphemy? And I believe the reason for that is because it was God's intent that it wouldn't be only the Jews who would kill his son, but that all of humanity would be involved. And it wouldn't only be the Romans and the Jews, would it? Because as this works out, we're going to see that those who had travelled from all over the known world to Jerusalem for the Passover would join in the demand to have Jesus crucified. And they began to accuse him, verse 2, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king." You see, Pilate wouldn't sentence a man to death merely on the basis of a theological issue. So the Jews had to come up with these kind of trumped up charges to give to Pilate. I mean, had Jesus forbidden his followers to pay taxes? Of course not. He did just the opposite, didn't he? We all know that. I mean, in Matthew 22:21, he said, "Render unto Caesar's things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." And Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered and said to him, "You're saying it." Then said Pilate to the chief priests and to the people, "I find no fault in this man." And they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place." When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man was a Galilean, were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was also at Jerusalem at that time. Now, what a lot of people don't realise when they look at this is the fact that Pilate was already in quite a bit of hot water and trouble as regards Rome. And you already have a couple of black marks against him with the Jews as well, due to the riots that erupted when he ordered his soldiers to go onto the Temple Mount, because they were carrying Roman insignias with them, and the Jews perceived those to be idols, and a riot started. And then he had further real problems when he paid for the construction of an aqueduct with money he took from the temple treasury. So being already in political hot water, and an effort to deflect some of the blame here, he was no doubt really relieved and pleased to find this loophole and send him to Herod so that he wouldn't have to deal with it. And so in verse 8, it says this. He says, "And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see him of a long season." He'd been dying to see him almost, and because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. Then he questioned with him, Herod and Jesus, in many words, but Jesus, he answered nothing. So when Jesus gets there, Herod asks him for a miracle. I mean, even though Jesus' entire earthly ministry had been filled with miracles, Herod is to be only the first who will ask Jesus for yet another one. I mean, the Sanhedrin said, "Prophesy who hit you. Come down off the cross," the crowd are going to jeer later on. And sadly enough, the same thing goes on today, doesn't it? Why doesn't God answer my prayer? Why doesn't he let me have this job? Why doesn't he bless this relationship? Why isn't he providing for my needs? Why doesn't he show me a miracle? Because I believe if only I could just see him do something. But you see, miracles don't produce faith, do they? All they produce is an addiction to see more miracles. I mean, you only have to read the book of Exodus, don't you? And you'll see, you know, the Red Sea parting, manna falling, water flowing out of a rock. And yet so faithless were the children of Israel after seeing miracle after miracle that they still didn't want to talk to God. You see, signs and miracles and wonders, they don't produce faith, because they invariably just leave people confused about the miracles that didn't happen. You know, people might see 10 events take place that are answers to prayer, but the one prayer that doesn't get answered the way they want it to is the one that gives everybody hang-ups. And that's why miracles are never enough. Now, does this mean that the Father won't do miracles? Of course he will. But again, you see, the miracles of God, they are never about power. They're about people. And whenever the Lord is working in the area of healing, it's with individual people. It's not about a massive demonstration of his power in order to persuade cynics. And I believe that's why 7 times in Mark's gospel, concerning his healings, Jesus said, "Don't tell anyone." Jesus cares about people, not about power. And the most powerful miracle of all was his resurrection from the dead. And yet, following this glorious event, how many times did Jesus appear to unbelievers? Not once. Yeah, okay, he appeared to Thomas, but Thomas was a believer. He was just away one Sunday and he missed something important. But he never appeared to Pilate or to Herod or to the religious leaders saying, "I'm back." Didn't do that, did he? No, it was only those who already believed in him who saw the resurrected Lord. So who is the one who sees the miracles and the blessings? Well, I believe it's the person who isn't seeking them, but who simply loves Jesus. So I think it's worth taking note of that, you know. And then verse 10 says, "And the chief priests and scribes stood vehemently..." "And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. And Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate." Now, that word vehemently comes from the Latin word, surprisingly, vehement, meaning what it means is deprived of mind. So Herod is out of his mind with anger at Jesus, very angry indeed, and it's all simply because Jesus wouldn't perform during his command performance. And verse 12 says, "And the same day Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before they were at enmity between themselves." I mean, it's just incredible, this, isn't it? Because it seems in their hatred of Jesus, Herod and Pilate now all of a sudden become friends. But it's all going to backfire. It's not going to last for long, because history tells us that Pilate would become insane and Herod would be of no help to him. It's amazing. And in verse 13 it says, "And Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and rulers of the people, said to them, 'You've brought this man to me as one that perverts the people. And behold, I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man touching those things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him. And lo, nothing worthy of death is done to him. I will therefore chastise him and release him.'" So, bottom line is, it's got nothing to do with what Jesus had done. Regardless of the fact that neither he nor Herod could find any fault with Jesus, Pilate is going to order that Jesus be scourged. And in his attempts to appease everyone, he's going to satisfy no one. And verse 17 says, "For of necessity he must release one to them at the feast. And they cried out all at once, saying, 'Away with this man, release Barabbas to us,' who, for a certain sedition made in the city and for murder, was cast into prison." So, ironically, it was left to the crowd to choose between Barabbas, who had been charged with insurrection, and Jesus, whose ministry would be based on resurrection. And even to this day, there are those who want to bring the kingdom in violently or politically or legalistically. But you've simply got to realise that the Lord's kingdom is not of this world. It is not of this world. It's a different kingdom altogether. It has nothing whatsoever to do with what's going on out there in the world, except, of course, to rescue people from it. It's a different kingdom. And in Revelation 14, verses 18 and 19, we read, "And another angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in your sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God." You see, there are two vines mentioned in Scripture. One is the vine whose vine dresser is the Lord, who Jesus said, "My Father is the gardener in the of the vine." The other vine is the world, which consists of the society of the world at large, and industry, and the media, and the governments, and all those who aren't the Lord's. And that is the vine of the earth, which is going to be cut off. This angel plunges in his sickle and cuts it off and gathers it and casts it into the winepress of the wrath of God. So you really need to sort out once and for all which vine you are part of. It is as simple as that. Because the Lord is coming, and you may not have long to do it. Because this world of ours, it's in a real mess, and you only have to look on the TV and listen to the news to find that out. I mean, everybody is arguing with everybody else, everybody's got opinions, and only their opinion is the right opinion. It's everywhere. Our culture today is built on that kind of mentality. And I hope you understand what I'm saying here when I say, and I know it's not PC, but it's like the inmates have taken over the asylum. When you look out there and see what's going on, how long is it going to be before the Lord comes back? Well, if this world carries on the way it's going, we'll all be saying, "Come on, Lord, come now. We can't take it anymore." And look, it's like this. It's like this. He's supposed to be coming like a thief in the night when nobody expects him, right? So if he waits much more, it's not going to be a surprise anymore, is it? So it has to be very soon. Barabbas thought he could bring in the kingdom with some kind of revolution. And many in the world still think that they can do it that way. But the plain truth is, only Jesus can bring in the true kingdom through regeneration and through the new birth. The crowd here, they wanted activity, not spirituality. They wanted insurrection, not resurrection. And because of that, they wanted to do something and not be something. And so they chose Barabbas. And then verse 20 says this: Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spoke again to them. But they cried, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And he said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." And they were instant with loud voices, requiring that he might be crucified. And the voices of them and of the chief priests prevailed. And Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. And he released to them him that for sedition and murder was cast into prison, whom they had desired, but he delivered Jesus to their will. You see, Pilate, he heard two voices very clearly: the voice of his conscience and the voice of the crowd. And he succumbed to the voice of the crowd. Historians tell us that shortly after this event happened, Pilate went into isolation on the island of Sicily, and that he was approached years later by a disciple of Jesus, who asked him if he remembered Jesus of Nazareth. And apparently a blank look came over his face and he said, "Jesus of Nazareth? I don't remember a thing about him." But in actual fact, so haunted was Pilate that shortly afterwards he hung himself, as did Judas. And I was thinking about this, you know, and how tragic it is when any of us give in to the loud voice of the crowd instead of submitting to the still small voice of the Holy Spirit within us. Verse 26 says this, "And as they led him away, they laid hold upon one Simon, a Cyrenian, coming out of the country, and on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus." So we come to this man, Simon of Cyrene. Mark gives us a bit more of an explanation about who he is, because he tells us that they took a man named Simon, a Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus, and they compelled to bear the cross. So as he writes that, Mark obviously takes it for granted that his readers early on in the church will know who these guys are, Simon and Alexander and Rufus. And Simon is from this area of Libya, North Africa. And he's come 600 or 700 miles by sea to be at the Passover. It was even further by land. And this may be a once-in-a-lifetime trip for him. And I'm sure that he didn't fully realise how it would all turn out, you know, when he started out for this Passover. And again, it's interesting because this is probably the Simon that's called Niger, that's mentioned in Acts chapter 13, who we see there fasting and praying with the prophets and ministering to the Lord there. And of course, Simon, as we know, was the abbreviated form of Simeon, And his son Rufus is mentioned in Romans chapter 16. And church tradition tells us that Rufus becomes the head of the church in Spain. And also that Simon's other son, Alexander, dies a martyr's death early on in the history of the church. So this man, you know, he comes to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. And as he comes, he's no doubt filled with wonder at the sights and the sounds all around him that, you know, going on in Jerusalem at Passover time. And somehow there's a commotion going on. Somehow he hears that something's happening. Did he see Jesus riding on Palm Sunday? We're not sure. But somehow he gets involved in this scene. And he probably knows about Jesus being beaten and the scourging as well. And probably dehydration has set in by now. And his physical frame is too weak to carry the cross by himself. And now, all of a sudden, they grab him from the crowd and they force him to carry the cross. It's interesting that history tells us that it was the right of Rome to lay a spear on your shoulder and have you carry something for a mile. And no doubt that's what's going on here. And maybe at this point in the proceeding, Simon's thinking, you know, I just wanted to celebrate the Passover and now look what I'm doing. I'm getting all covered in blood and messed up and I'm going to be defiled and I'm going to have to go through a cleansing process. I'm going to miss most of the feast. Oh, is this what I get? I spent good money to get here. I took the ship, paid my passage on the boat, all the way from Libya. And instead of taking part in the Passover, here I am getting all messy. If only I'd got up a bit earlier, you know. A bit later, not earlier. If only I'd got up a bit later. If only I hadn't pushed to the front of the crowd to see what was going on. And here they are now. They take him and he carries this cross. Here he is carrying the cross. And I've got no doubt in my mind, by the familiarity that the New Testament expresses towards him, that this Simon of Cyrene, or Cyrene, depends how you want to say it, you know, comes to understand now what the true Passover was all about and who the true Passover lamb happened to be. And it changes his life and the lives of his two sons as well forever. And of course, the only reason for the Passover feast in the first place was to look forward to this Lamb of God that would come and take away the sin of the world. And I can't help wondering, you know, what it must have been like for Simon after this, thinking back to this moment. I think his initial surprise and thoughts of getting covered in blood and being defiled for the feast, you know, I reckon they must have all been just a distant memory. I mean, looking back, he must have thought to himself, Lord, I can't believe that of all the human beings on this earth, you chose me, and I got to carry the cross for my Saviour. And, you know, it's easy for us as we look at this to think, well, man, what a privilege. But, you know, Simon had never read this chapter. He didn't know the story. And we can maybe think, wow, you know, if I was there, I'd have fought tooth and nail just for a mere chance to carry that cross for you, Lord. Well, if that's what you're thinking, I've got good news for you. Because there's plenty of cross to go round. And I'm not talking about, you know, you used to be able to go to the Church of the Holy Crucifixion in Jerusalem and buy splinters from the cross. And that had been happening for around 1,400 years. And finally, someone said to those folks, well, you know, you've been selling splinters for 1,400 years. And if you've been doing that, the cross would have been gone long ago. And they went back and they thought about it. And then they came back and said, well, it's a miracle. It's called the multiplication of the cross. And as soon as we peel back a splinter, as soon as we take one off, another one grows back again. Well, that's not what we're talking about here, OK? What we're talking about here is that there's plenty of cross to go round because he said, if you want to follow me, take up your cross and follow me. So there is nothing whatsoever stopping us from taking up the cross that he has for us to carry on his behalf. And when the day comes, when we stand in front of him, I tell you, we won't regret a moment of it. So this man, Simon, now is put under the weight of this beam, carrying it because Jesus' human frame is failing him. So, you know, as we look at all this and we read these verses, the implication is that Simon got saved perhaps the very day he carried that cross. And I guess this shouldn't surprise us, should it really? Because those who carry the cross of Christ will always fall in love with him. You know, initially we might say, oh no, oh, I don't want to go through that. I don't want to do that. It's too heavy. It's too much of a burden. Why me? But I think eventually all of us come to understand the incredible insight that Jesus shared with us when he said, it's the person who carries his cross daily who finds true life. Let's bow our hearts to pray.